Hi folks, this is Rue.
And Dave.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Today we continue with A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline Eng and Chapter 6, The Happy Medium.
So, there might be a little difference in tone and quality this week. We had a bit of a difference last week. We used a program that noise-gated both our microphones, and that kind of got rid of a lot of the background. But now I've got a new setup, and it turns out I can't use that software with my new setup because it lags me behind. So I'm not using it, but I have a new microphone. Rue is using it. She's got her old good microphone, so we're going to see how this sounds.
And hopefully there will be no lag.
No, I mean, we can't stop either one or both of our internets deciding to go bleh, but
yeah,
that happens regardless.
Yes.
Because for the foreseeable future, I don't think it is feasible for us to be in the same place, even though I'm only like 5 minutes down the street.
Yeah, it's the joys of having the plague currently locally infesting. And I'm not taking any risks personally. And I know Dave is being very cautious, but it's, yeah.
Yeah.
The odds go up.
I'm still out and about, you know, for work and going to the shops, et cetera, et cetera.
We tunnel down our groceries, so we try and keep it very, very limited. So it becomes a shop once every, like, maybe fortnight, and then if there's one thing missing or two things missing, like, we can be fine without it, unless it's something absolutely required. We're fine. We don't need it. We don't need to get it. It's fine. The only things that I think the staples have to stay, but everything else, we're not just going to the shops for one thing.
Mm.
That being said, I think my mom's just popped out because she's trying to make. She's occupying herself, making clothing for my nieces and nephew. And what is, like, I've gone out to get bias tape and something like, okay, Mom, why? It's okay. It's sometimes it's for sanity purposes. So fair. But right now, yes, we're just trying to do our best to stay away from
death.
Yeah. Yeah, it's rough. It's rough. Fun fact, though, this last week, last Saturday, we had around midnight, and then so Saturday evening, early Sunday, we had a really bad electrical storm.
Oh, it was frightening.
It was rough. Because we're in neighbor suburbs now, so we were previously a little bit further apart, but this was a massive storm. Mm-hmm. And we had a lightning bolt hit. We had two lightning bolts. One hit about a few streets away, and one that must have hit much closer because the lightning and thunder were simultaneous.
Oh!
So it was under 300 meters, because that's, of course, how we determine the distance. Mm-hmm. Because of the speed of sound. Yeah.
And when they are almost instantaneous, your walls shake, your windows shake.
Yes. I mean, that can happen even when they're not instantaneous. It depends. True. On the size of the bolt. But yeah, I remember times where we've had this rumbling, and we're going, what's going on? Oh, it's rumbling because the thunder is that loud. It's been, those bolts have been that large that they're causing the shockwave from the lightning is causing problems.
Yeah.
It's rare, but it has happened. But yeah, so Saturday, Sunday, my lightning bolt hit near our street, which also meant that our power went a bit funny, but we lost a router, and the router, but the power was fine. So the power that it was plugged into, that wasn't where the problem was originating. It was actually the cable from the cable modem. that conducted the electricity, and the cable modem was mostly fine. It was just those parts of the modem had obviously been fried. So the part that the Ethernet cable comes through got fried.
Damn.
And we're going, how? And it was still blinking, but there were issues with it, and we couldn't figure out what. I called my ISP, and it's 24 hours of us just troubleshooting, swapping cables, swapping, testing out with an older router, et cetera, and him doing tests on his site, and going, this isn't, there's just like one step missing. There's something, it's not, something's not communicating.
Hmm.
And to the point where the router's like, you haven't plugged anything in. It's like, the modem cable is right there. You are plugged into both. Am I a joke to you? Anyway, it was this whole debate. I was having discussions with the routers. And then he's like, yeah, let's send in the repair people. Repair people come, they swap the modem out because usually they'll argue. It's like, oh, no, you have to try this. You have to have you switched it on and off again, mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. And you're going, my God, the number of cycles I went through was ridiculous. But they didn't even argue. They immediately went, oh, what street? Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're coming in. We've got a couple of calls for that area. I'm like, okay. So we were not the only modem that got fried that night. So the entire street, I think, must have been affected because there was a whole bunch of us. So the guys just like come in, I think on like on a Wednesday, and just got everything sorted for most of the street. But yeah, it was, yes. So I had a crispy modem that was not quite crispy. It was a half crispy modem, and that fried the router completely. And so I had to set that all up and spent basically, so most of the week was spent just getting the internet working again because our house is small and lots of walls and a bit strange. And so organizing it in a way that the internet actually reaches my office and it's a bit tricky. So I have to set up the mesh again from scratch. And sometimes devices recognize it, sometimes they don't. It's basically a whole few days worth of organizing. Hence, we are recording slightly later than usual, putting all the pressure on poor Dave to edit in a very short amount of time. Apologies.
It'll be okay. It's just my Sunday out the window.
I'm sorry.
No, my Sunday, I usually do laundry and a quick clean of the apartment, so I should be able to edit in between all that.
All good. And yeah, we've got... but, so yeah, Dave also... I've been reading books, as I said, this one series of books, like back to back, and it's now, my streak has been broken, where I was like reading at least a book or two books a day. My streak was broken because Dave gave me a birthday gift, and it was really, and it's been distracting me for the last, I think 48 hours or so. So yesterday I started playing a little bit, going, ooh, this is really cool. And it's Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's Vault.
Heaven's Vault? I thought it was Heaven's Gate. Heaven's Vault.
Isn't Heaven's Gate a cult that did some...
Actually, that would be why I'm remembering Heaven's Gate as opposed to Heaven's Vault. Thank you. Correction. So Heaven's Vault, and it's been really nice. There's creepy moments. I'm trying to stop clicking. I'm trying to... it's eerie. The aesthetic is very cool.
It's science fiction archaeology, which I thought was kind of neat when I tried.
Yeah, it's science fiction archaeology, and also it feels like to the point where if you've gone so far into the future that the past is like you've gone and done. It's strange. There's an interesting feel about it. It's really well done. If you liked, I mean, there's parts of if you liked things like I guess The Longest Journey or. Dave is better at this part of these kind of things because video games are Dave's jam. But yeah, if it feels a little bit like Longest Journey and things like that, kind of that vibe.
It's got more of an adventure game vibe, even though the amount I played, there were no puzzles to speak of. It was primarily a narrative experience. I mean, okay, there were a couple things where you have to work out a foreign language from context clues. And I did that a couple times. Aside from sailing a slipstream, which was really cool, and then just choosing dialogue, I'd say, yeah, it's more heavily weighed towards just a straightforward narrative experience rather than a gameplay experience, which
it's, yeah. And I wonder if the endings and the interactions change based on your narrative selections. I don't know if someone's, I'm sure someone's done an analysis of it, but yeah,
it's interesting. There was someone on Twitter who I follow who was talking about wanting to make different choices, but she's already played the game twice and she doesn't know if she could do a third playthrough without her disliking the game because she spent so much time with it now.
Yeah, it is. I know people who've been playing it again and again and again, and I think for them, because they describe it as my first loop, they actually refer to that loops are part of the belief system of this game. So there's this not belief system of the game, but in the game there's the belief in the loop, and that everyone lives again and again and again and again and again, and is funny, because I think it's for a video game to have that belief is funny to me.
Yeah,
because yes. Indeed, you could do this a few loops. So people, I've seen some people referring to when they replay it a few times as it being a loop, and then depending on what happens, that things randomly spawn, like clues spawn randomly. They're not the same clues every time.
Well, I mean, also, if the game just makes you feel like you get a different experience, if you play it again, it's doing its job. That was the illusion of the Telltale adventure games like The Walking Dead and Tales from the Borderlands, where everyone who played The Walking Dead Season 1 marveled at how it felt like you could replay the game, make different choices, and the game would respond. But it turned out, really, aside from a couple moments that kind of slotted different characters in different places, it was pretty much the same the entire way through. It's just the game did a beautiful job, like a master magician, of making you think that you are making significant changes to the narrative.
So I'm just thinking of also other games, particularly the BioWare games, that really stand out for having that kind of approach, as well. It's choices, the whole Paragon versus Renegade in Mass Effect. So choices. It's interesting how a lot of those, the ones that have really very memorable games, heavily have choices as part of their design, their narrative, choice, the concept of choice.
Well, if you want to get technical about it, even the ones that are primarily gameplay, you're fighting games, or, you know, something like Dark Souls or a Mario platformer, you are making choices every second. Now, they are like dexterous choices. They are what button to press, what attack do I choose, what do I do in this moment. But the idea of making a weighty narrative decision is just another shade of what video games provide.
I think the idea is that they are, when your narrative or the function of your game, so yes, there's choices of fighting or which move you make or everything, but in terms of, I guess, when your story, your story depends on choice.
Yeah.
And your story emphasizes that choices are what determines the outcome. That's really cool to me, because it feels like it's something that, it's something that connects, like a really well-written book has a similar concept where you look at the character and you go, do I relate to the choices they made?
Oh, no, that's not just a sign of a good narrative, but I think that's kind of the linchpin of strong drama. When, you know, especially if you like reread a book or a play over and over, and you're like, you keep getting to a point where, like, oh, if they just made that different decision right here, it would have ended up differently. But of course, because the story can only go one way, it becomes a fun what if. But always you're kind of, it's that sadness where you realize, oh, but it has to be this way. Now, yes, in games, I guess there's a joy in that. If the game has been programmed to allow for that much divergence, because here's another secret where the idea of every time you have like a meaningful like narrative choice in the video game, you've just doubled the amount of work you have to put into making the game to flesh out those choices. And then if those choices, it's just this ever branching tree that can get very overwhelming very quickly. Like one of BioWare's very lauded games, going back to that company, Dragon Age Origins. They spent they spent 6 years making that game. That game, from my understanding, that game does have some meaningful choices in it, but that's why they were able to dedicate the time and resources to do that. Meanwhile, the second game, which I know is panned by many fans of the series, that game, I think they had a year to make it. So yeah, you see the difference.
Well, I was thinking it reminds me of the Choose Your Own Adventure books as well, like that kind of, but what if I do this? Oh, no.
go the right path or die.
Yeah. Well, so now bringing it back. Mm-hmm. So this is where it gets interesting, bringing it back to the book that we are currently reading. Mm-hmm. So we had last chapter, which where we've met the happy medium. There's other things that happen too, but still. And they saw the kids are shown Earth, and they're shown how there's a shadow, that the Earth is becoming shadowed, and they're going, okay, it's that thing. That's what their father's fighting. And then this idea of, I hate the dark thing, and we all do. That's why we are trying to fight it. And there's been lots of people who've come from Earth who've also got a history of fighting. And then you've got all these people listed that made the choice to try and impact on the world. That people make choices that, and this idea of the scale being from the smallest microorganism, sub-microscopic kind of level up to the vastness of the cosmos.
Oh, I'd like to just interject there, because the game I'm making my next video on touches on that a little. I wrote this because one of the linchpins of the game is discussing Schrodinger's cat, you know, the physics experiment where the cat is both simultaneously alive or dead until you open the box and you see, it's only at that point where the universe basically makes that decision, and then it has always been that way. Kind of a wild thing to wrap your head around. But this game also deals with multiverses, you know, where every choice, every decision plays out in a different multiverse. And the main character is able to jump his consciousness into his body in different multiverses to play out different scenarios. But
that's really cool.
They talk about how wild the idea of Schrodinger's cat is on the quantum level, because, yeah, you know, when you go down to subatomic particles, they're all in flux. We're all made of the last episode. You talked about, you know, what stops our hand moving through the table when it's all pretty much empty space. It's all the same stuff vibrating at different frequencies. And the point I wanted to make then, going down to the smallest thing, well, if every choice, the way these subatomic particles relate to each other, have an effect, well, that means even air currents can create other universes.
Whoa.
You know,
it gets really trippy. Yeah.
When you're going down that small.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, now the funny thing about just what I talked about, because every time I finish playing a session of a video game that I'm making a video on, I type, you know, out a bunch of notes about my reflections and how everything that happened, how I'm feeling about it, and the ideas I have. And after, like, the whole Schrodinger's cat multiverse explanation happened in the game, I wrote this big thing about, well, what does that mean for causality when an air current can influence multiverses and the whole idea of fate and everything. And it was like, as I was writing, I'm like, this is good stuff. Oh, this is going to be like the linchpin of my video. And it turns out what I ended up writing my script about has nothing to do with this at all, so I never used it.
Sounds about right. It is the way.
But before I went off on a tangent, you were talking about the choices and how it the impact.
Well, and this is the thing, like these kids are now also being faced with a choice. And it's interesting because you've got these people from history that are being mentioned. Right? So Jesus, Copernicus, like all these great, the transformative characters of our history that have had an influence on our movement as humanity, so to speak. And these kids are being now told, hey, yes, your dad, well, for two of them, your dad is out there and is also finding that thing, and you are also, like, you're going out there to help your dad.
Mm. Because he might be able to do what he needs to do for someone else because he can't do it for himself.
That. And that's, again, choice. And that's an interesting one. That brings us the concepts of choice, motivation, volition, all these things. Like, they all come in. And these are concepts being presented here, I mean, in the book to children. But mm-hmm. this is a book meant for children, maybe young, like, maybe adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
This author does not belittle the capacity of adolescents to tackle and children to tackle complex and difficult concepts.
Mm.
And I find that refreshing. And in an author to see that, that's always good. That's always beautiful. And it's always been, and this is one of, as I said, one of the earlier science fiction novels that you're going to get targeted towards this age group.
Mm.
But now we were going to find out, we're going to see a little bit more about what's going on, because remember, Happy Medium has been told for the pleasant things to happen, for us to be able to enjoy and look upon pleasant things, we need to actually deal with and be responsible for the unpleasant things and deal with it, right? And poor Happy Medium is now at the point of tears and sobbing and is being made to show them more.
Made to show them the earth.
Yes, more about the earth.
Okay, well, let's get to it.
Chapter 6, The Happy Medium. Again, they focus their eyes on the crystal ball. The earth, with its fearful covering of dark shadow, swam out of view, and they moved rapidly through the Milky Way. And there was the thing again. Watch, the medium told them. The darkness seemed to seethe and writhe. Was this meant to comfort them? Suddenly, there was a great burst of light through the darkness. The light spread out, and where it touched the darkness disappeared. The light spread until the patch of dark thing had vanished, and there was only a gentle shining, and through the shining came the stars, clear and pure. Then slowly the shining dwindled until it, too, was gone, and there was nothing but stars and starlight. No shadows, no fear. Only the stars and the clear darkness of space, quite different from the fearful darkness of the thing. You see, the happy medium cried, smiling happily. It can be overcome. It is being overcome all the time. Mrs. Watsit sighed, a sigh so sad that Meg wanted to put her arms around her and comfort her. Tell us exactly what happened then, please, Charles Wallace said in a small voice. It was a star, Mrs. Watsit said sadly. A star giving up its life in battle with the thing. It won. Oh, yes, my children, it won. But it lost its life in the winning. Mrs. Witch spoke again. Her voice sounded tired, and they knew that speaking was a tremendous effort for her. It was not so long ago for you, was it? She asked gently. Mrs. Watsit shook her head. Charles Wallace went up to Mrs. Watsit. I see. Now I understand. You were a star once, weren't you? Mrs. Watsit covered her face with her hands, as though she were embarrassed, and nodded. And you did what that star just did. With her face still covered, Mrs. Watsit nodded again.
Wow.
Charles Wallace looked at her very solemnly. I should like to kiss you. Mrs. Watsit took her hands down from her face and pulled Charles Wallace to her in a quick embrace. He put his arms about her neck, pressed his cheek against hers, and then kissed her. Meg felt that she would have liked to kiss Mrs. Watsit too, but that after Charles Wallace, anything that she or Calvin did or said would be an anticlimax. She contented herself with looking at Mrs. Watsit. Even though she was used to Mrs. Watsit's odd get-up, and the very oddness of it was what made her seem so comforting, she realized with a fresh shock that it was not Mrs. Watsit herself that she was seeing at all. The complete, the true Mrs. Watsit, Meg realized, was beyond human understanding. What she saw was only the game Mrs. Watsit was playing. It was an amusing and charming game, a game full of both laughter and comfort. But it was only the tiniest facet of all the things Mrs. Watsit could be.
Hmm.
I didn't mean to tell you, Mrs. Watsit faltered. I didn't mean ever to let you know. But oh, my dears, I did so love being a star. You are still very young, Mrs. Witch said, her voice faintly chiding. The medium sat, looking happily at the star-filled sky in her bowl, smiling and nodding and chuckling gently. But Meg noticed that her eyes were drooping, and suddenly her head fell forward, and she gave a faint snore. Poor thing, Mrs. Watsit said. We've worn her out. It's very hard work for her. Please, Mrs. Watsit, Meg asked, what happens now? Why are we here, and what do we do next? Where is Father? When are we going to him? She clasped her hands pleadingly. One thing at a time, love, Mrs. Watsit said. Mrs. Hu cut in. Asperedas tem ouvidos. That's Portuguese. Walls have ears. Yes, let us go outside, Mrs. Watsit said. Come, we'll let her sleep. But as they turned to go, the medium jerked her head up and smiled at them radiantly. You weren't going to go without saying goodbye to me, were you? She asked. We thought we'd just let you sleep, dear, Mrs. Watsit patted the medium's shoulder. We worked you terribly hard, and we know you must be very tired. But I was going to give you some ambrosia or nectar, or at least some tea. At this, Meg realized that she was hungry. How much time had passed since they had had their bowls of stew, she wondered. But Mrs. Watsit said, Oh, thank you, dear, but I think we'd better be going. They don't need to eat, you know, Charles Wallace whispered to Meg, at least not food the way we do. Eating is just a game with them. As soon as we get organized again, I'd better remind them that they'll have to feed us sooner or later. The medium smiled and nodded. It does seem as though I should be able to do something nice for you, after having had to show those poor children such horrid things. Would they like to see their mother before they go? Could we see Father? Meg asked eagerly. No, Mrs. Witch said. We are going to your father, Meg. Do not be impatient. But she could see her mother, couldn't she? The medium wheedled. Oh, why not? Mrs. Watsit put in. It won't take long, and it can't do any harm. And Calvin, too? Meg asked. Could he see his mother, too? Calvin touched Meg in a quick gesture, and whether it was of thanks or apprehension, she was not sure. I think it is a mistake, Mrs. Witch was disapproving. But since you have mentioned it, I suppose you must go ahead. I hate it when she gets cross, Mrs. Watsit said, glancing over at Mrs. Witch. And the trouble is, she always seems to be right. But I really don't see how it could hurt, and it might make you all feel better. Go on, medium dear. The medium, smiling and humming softly, turned the crystal ball a little between her hands. Stars, comets, planets flashed across the sky, and then the earth came into view again, the darkened earth, closer, closer, till it filled the globe. And they had somehow gone through the darkness until the soft white of clouds and the gentle outline of continents shone clearly. Calvin's mother first, Meg whispered to the medium. The glow became hazy, cloudy. Then shadows began to solidify, to clarify, and they were looking into an untidy kitchen with a sink full of unwashed dishes. In front of the sink stood an unkempt woman, with grey hair stringing about her face. Her mouth was open, and Meg could see the toothless gums, and it seemed that she could almost hear her screaming at two small children who were standing by her. Then she grabbed a long wooden spoon from the sink, and began whacking one of the children. Oh, dear, the medium murmured, and the picture began to dissolve. I didn't really. It's all right, Calvin said in a low voice. I think I'd rather you knew. Now, instead of reaching out to Calvin for safety, Meg took his hand in hers, not saying anything in words, but trying to tell him, by the pressure of her fingers, what she felt. If anyone had told her only the day before that she, Meg, the snaggletooth, the myopic, the clumsy, would be taking a boy's hand to offer him comfort and strength, particularly a popular and important boy like Calvin, the idea would have been beyond her comprehension. But now it seemed as natural to want to help and protect Calvin as it did Charles Wallace. So you see, there's a shift.
Mm.
And it's interesting because the whole, you know, damsel in distress needing comfort. Well, no, everyone needs comfort. Everyone needs support.
Yeah.
We don't know the circumstances of everyone. And I think that's not a bad one. I have feelings about how the mother is portrayed, but it's just showing like you can't tell.
Mm-hmm.
The shadows were swirling in the crystal again, and as they cleared, Meg began to recognize her mother's lab at home. Mrs. Murray was sitting perched on her high stool, writing away at a sheet of paper on a clipboard on her lap. She's writing Father, Meg thought, the way she always does, every night. The tears that she could never learn to control swam to her eyes as she watched. Mrs. Murray looked up from her letter, almost as though she were looking toward the children, and then her head drooped, and she put it down on the paper and sat there, huddled up, letting herself relax into an unhappiness that she never allowed her children to see. And now the desire for tears left Meg, the hot, protective anger she had felt for Calvin when she looked into his house, she now felt turned toward her mother. "Let's go," she cried harshly. "Let's do something." "She's always so right," Mrs. Watson murmured, looking towards Mrs. Witch. "Sometimes I wish she'd just say, 'I told you so,' and have done with it."
"I only meant to help," the medium wailed.
"Oh, medium dear, don't feel badly," Mrs. Watson said swiftly. "Look at something cheerful, do. I can't bear to have you distressed." "It's all right," Meg assured the medium earnestly. "Truly it is, Mrs. Medium, and we thank you very much."
"Are you sure?" the medium asked, brightening.
"Of course. It really helped ever so much because it made me mad, and when I'm mad, I don't have room to be scared."
"It's true. It's very hard to be, but..."
"Well, kiss me goodbye for good luck, then," the medium said. Meg went over to her and gave her a quick kiss, and so did Charles Wallace. The medium looked smilingly at Calvin and winked. "I want the young man to kiss me, too. I always did love red hair, and it'll give you good luck, laddie me love." Calvin bent down, blushing, and awkwardly kissed her cheek. The medium tweaked his nose. "You've got a lot to learn, my boy," she told him. "Now, goodbye, medium dear, and many thanks," Mrs. Watson said. "I dare say we'll see you in an eon or two." "Where are you going, in case I want to tune in?" the medium asked. "Kamazots," Mrs. Watson told her. Where and what was Kamazots? Meg did not like the sound of the word, or the way in which Mrs. Watson pronounced it. "But please don't distress yourself on our behalf. You know you don't like looking in on the dark planets, and it's very upsetting to us when you aren't happy." "But I must know what happens to the children," the medium said. "It's my worst trouble, getting fond. If I didn't get fond, I could be happy all the time." "Oh, well, ho-hum. I managed to keep pretty jolly, and a little snooze will do wonders for me right now. Goodbye, every—" and a word got lost in the general bzzz of a snore. "Come," Mrs. Witch ordered, and they followed her out of the darkness of the cave to the impersonal greyness of the medium's planet. "Now, children, you must not be frightened at what is going to happen," Mrs. Witch warned. "Stay angry, little Meg," Mrs. Watson whispered. "You will need all your anger now." Without warning, Meg was swept into nothingness again. This time the nothingness was interrupted by a feeling of clammy coldness, such as she had never felt before. The coldness deepened and swirled all about her and through her, and was filled with a new and strange kind of darkness that was a completely tangible thing, a thing that wanted to eat and digest her like some enormous malignant beast of prey. Then the darkness was gone. Had it been the shadow, the black thing? Had they had to travel through it to get to her father? There was the by now familiar tingling in her hands and feet, and the push-through hardness, and she was on her feet, breathless but unharmed, standing beside Calvin and Charles Wallace. "Is this Kamazot?" Charles Wallace asked, as Mrs. Watson materialized in front of him. "Yes," she answered. "Now let us just stand and get our breath and look around." They were standing on a hill, and as Meg looked about her, she felt that it could easily be a hill on earth. There were the familiar trees she knew so well at home, birches, pines, maples,
and though it was warmer than it had been when they so precipitously left their apple orchard, there was a faintly autumnal touch to the air. Near them there were several small trees with reddened leaves very much like sumac, and a big patch of goldenrod-like flowers. As she looked down the hill, she could see the smokestacks of a town, and it might have been one of any number of familiar towns. There seemed to be nothing strange, or different, or frightening in the landscape. But Mrs. Watsit came to her and put an arm around her comfortingly. "I can't stay here. I can't stay with you here, you know, love," she said. "You three children will be on your own. We will be near you. We will be watching you. But you will not be able to see us or ask us for help, and we will not be able to come to you." "But is father here?" Meg asked tremblingly. "Yes. But where? When will we see him?" She was poised for running, as though she were going to sprint off immediately to wherever her father was. "That I cannot tell you. You will just have to wait until the propitious moment." Charles Wallace looked steadily at Mrs. Watsit. "Are you afraid for us?"
"A little."
"But if you weren't afraid to do what you did, when you were a star, why should you be afraid for us now?"
"But I was afraid," Mrs. Watsit said gently. She looked steadily at each of the three children in turn. "You will need help," she told them, "but all I am allowed to give you is a little talisman. Calvin, your great gift is your ability to communicate with all kinds of people. So for you, I will strengthen this gift. Meg, I give you your faults."
"My faults?" Meg cried. "Your faults. But I'm always trying to get rid of my faults."
"Yes," Mrs. Watsit said. "However, I think you'll find they'll come in very handy on Kamiksots."
"Charles Wallace, to you I can give only the resilience of your childhood." From somewhere, Mrs. Hu's glasses glimmered, and they heard her voice. "Calvin," she said, "a hint, for you a hint. Listen well. For that he was a spirit too delicate to act their earthly and abhorred commands, refusing their grand hests, they did confine him, by help of the most potent ministers, and in their most unmitigable rage, into a cloven pine, within which rift imprisoned he did painfully remain." Shakespeare, The Tempest.
"Where are you, Mrs. Hu?" Charles Wallace asked. "Where is Mrs. Witch?"
"We cannot come to you now," Mrs. Hu's voice blew to them like the wind. "Allwissend bin ich nicht, doch viel ist in mir bewisst. Goethe. I do not know everything, still many things I understand." "That is for you, Charles. Remember that you do not know everything." Then the voice was directed to Meg. "To you I leave my glasses, little blind as a bat, but do not use them except as a last resort. Save them for the final moment of peril." As she spoke, there was another shimmer of spectacles, and then it was gone, and the voice faded out with it. The spectacles were in Meg's hand. She put them carefully into the breast pocket of her blazer, and the knowledge that they were there somehow made her feel a little less afraid. "To all three of you I give my command," Mrs. Witch said. "Go down into the town. Go together. Do not let them separate you. Be strong." There was a flicker, and then it vanished. Meg shivered. Mrs. Watsit must have seen the shiver, for she patted Meg on the shoulder. Then she turned to Calvin. "Take care of Meg."
"I can take care of Meg," Charles Wallace said rather sharply. "I always have."
Mrs. Watsit looked at Charles Wallace, and the creaky voice seemed somehow both to soften and to deepen at the same time. "Charles Wallace, the danger here is greatest for you."
"Why?"
"Because of what you are. Just exactly because of what you are, you will be by far the most vulnerable. You must stay with Meg and Calvin. You must not go off on your own. Beware of pride and arrogance, Charles, for they may betray you." At the tone of Mrs. Watsit's voice, both warning and frightening, Meg shivered again, and Charles Wallace butted up against Mrs. Watsit in the way he often did with his mother, whispering, "Now I think I know what you meant about being afraid."
Only a fool is not afraid, Mrs. Watsit told him. Now go. And where she had been, there was only sky and grasses and a small rock. Come on, Meg said impatiently. Come on, let's go. She was completely unaware that her voice was trembling like an aspen leaf. She took Charles Wallace and Calvin each by the hand and started down the hill. Below them, the town was laid out in harsh, angular patterns. The houses and the outskirts were all exactly alike, small square boxes painted grey. Each had a small, rectangular plot of lawn in front, with a straight line of dull-looking flowers edging the path to the door. Meg had a feeling that if she could count the flowers, there would be exactly the same number for each house. In front of all the houses, children were playing. Some were skipping rope, some were bouncing balls. Meg felt vaguely that something was wrong with their play. It seemed exactly like children playing around any housing development at home, and yet there was something different about it. She looked at Calvin and saw that he, too, was puzzled. Look, Charles Wallace said suddenly, they're skipping and bouncing in rhythm. Everyone's doing it at exactly the same moment. This was so. As the skipping rope hit the pavement, so did the ball. As the rope curved over the head of the jumping child, the child with the ball caught the ball. Down came the ropes, down came the balls, over and over again. Up, down, all in rhythm, all identical, like the houses, like the paths, like the flowers. Then the doors of all the houses opened simultaneously, and out came women like a row of paper dolls. The print of their dresses was different, but they all gave the appearance of being the same. Each woman stood on the steps of her house. Each clapped. Each child with the ball caught the ball. Each child with the skipping rope folded the rope. Each child turned and walked into the house. The doors clicked shut behind them. How can they do it? Meg asked wonderingly. We couldn't do it that way if we tried. What does it mean? Let's go back. Calvin's voice was urgent. Back? Charles Wallace asked. Where? I don't know. Anywhere. Back to the hill. Back to Mrs. Watsit and Mrs. Who and Mrs. Witch. I don't like this. But they aren't there. Do you think they'd come back to us if we turned back now? I don't like it, Calvin said again. Come on. Impatience made Meg squeak. You know we can't go back. Mrs. Watsit said to go into the town. She started on down the street, and the two boys followed her. The houses, all identical, continued as far as the eye could reach. Then, all at once, they saw the same thing, and stopped to watch. In front of one of the houses stood a little boy with a ball, and he was bouncing it. But he bounced it rather badly, and with no particular rhythm, sometimes dropping it and running after it with awkward, furtive leaps, sometimes throwing it up into the air and trying to catch it. The door of his house opened, and out ran one of the mother figures. She looked wildly up and down the street, saw the children, and put her hand to her mouth, as though to stifle a scream, grabbed the little boy and rushed indoors with him. The ball dropped from his fingers and rolled out into the street. Charles Wallace ran after it and picked it up, holding it out for Meg and Calvin to see. It seemed like a perfectly ordinary brown rubber ball. Let's take it into him and see what happens, Charles Wallace suggested. Meg pulled at him. Mrs. Watsit said for us to go on into the town. Well, we are in the town, aren't we? The outskirts, anyhow. I want to know more about this. I have a hunch it may help us later. You go on if you don't want to come with me. No, Calvin said firmly. We are going to stay together. Mrs. Watsit said we weren't to let them separate us. But I'm with you on this. Let's knock and see what happens. They went up the path to the house. Meg reluctant, eager to get on into the town. Let's hurry, she begged. Please, don't you want to find father? Yes, Charles Wallace said, but not blindly. How can we help him if we don't know what we're up against? And it's obvious we've been brought here to help him, not just to find him. He walked briskly up the steps and knocked at the door. They waited. Nothing happened. Then Charles Wallace saw a bell, and this he rang. They could hear the bell buzzing in the house, and the sound of it echoed down the street. After a moment, the mother figure opened the door. All up and down the street the other doors opened, but only a crack, and eyes peered toward the three children and the woman looking fearfully out of the door at them. "What do you want?" she asked. "It isn't paper time yet. We've had milk time. We've had this month's Puller Prush person, and I've given my decency donations regularly. All my papers are in order." "I think your little boy dropped his ball," Charles Wallace said, holding it out. The woman pushed the ball away. "Oh, no, the children in our section never drop balls. They're all perfectly trained. We haven't had an aberration for 3 years." All up and down the block, heads nodded in agreement. Charles Wallace moved closer to the woman and looked past her into the house. Behind her in the shadows, he could see the little boy, who must have been about his own age. "You can't come in," the woman said. "You haven't shown me any papers. I don't have to let you in if you haven't any papers." Charles Wallace held the ball out beyond the woman so that the little boy could see it. Quick as a flash, the boy leapt forward and grabbed the ball from Charles Wallace's hand and then darted back into the shadows. The woman went very white, opened her mouth as though to say something, then slammed the door in their faces instead. All up and down the street, doors slammed. "What are they afraid of?" Charles Wallace asked. "What's the matter with them?" "Don't you know?" Meg asked him. "Don't you know what all this is about, Charles?" "Not yet," Charles Wallace said. "Not even an inkling. And I'm trying. But I didn't get through anywhere. Not even a chink." "Let's go." He stumped down the steps. After several blocks, the houses gave way to apartment buildings. At least Meg felt sure that that was what they must be. They were fairly tall, rectangular buildings, absolutely plain, each window, each entrance, exactly like every other. Then, coming toward them, down the street, was a boy about Calvin's age, riding a machine that was something like a combination of a bicycle and a motorcycle. It had the slimness and lightness of a bicycle, and yet, as the foot pedals turned, they seemed to generate an unseen source of power, so that the boy could pedal very slowly and yet move along the street quite swiftly. As he reached each entrance, he thrust one hand into a bag he wore slung over his shoulder, pulled out a roll of papers, and tossed it into the entrance. It might have been Dennis or Sandy or any one of hundreds of boys with a newspaper route in any one of hundreds of towns back home, and yet, as with the children playing ball and jumping rope, there was something wrong about it. The rhythm of the gesture never varied. The paper flew in identically the same arc at each doorway, landed in identically the same spot. It was impossible for anybody to throw with such consistent perfection. Calvin whistled. "I wonder if they play baseball here." As the boy saw them, he slowed down on his machine and stopped. His hand arrested as it was about to plunge into the paper bag. "What are you kids doing out on the street?" he demanded. "Only root boys are allowed out now. You know that." "No, we don't know that," Charles Wallace said. "We're strangers here. How about telling us something about this place?" "You mean you've had your entrance papers processed and everything?" the boy asked. "You must have, if you're here," he answered himself. "And what are you doing here if you don't know about us?" "You tell me," Charles Wallace said. "Are you examiners?" the boy asked a little anxiously. "Everybody knows our city has the best central intelligence center on the planet. Our production levels are the highest. Our factories never close. Our machines never stop rolling. Added to this, we have 5 poets, 1 musician, 3 artists, and 6 sculptors, all perfectly channeled." "What are you quoting from?" Charles Wallace asked. "The manual, of course," the boy said. "We are the most oriented city on the planet. There has been no trouble of any kind for centuries. All Kamazots knows our record. That's why we are the capital city of Kamazots. That is why Central Intelligence is located here. That is why it makes its home here." There was something about the way he said "it" that made a shiver run up and down Meg's spine. But Charles Wallace asked briskly, "Where is this Central Intelligence Center of yours?" Central, the boy corrected. "Just keep going and you can't miss it. You are strangers, aren't you? What are you doing here?" "Are you supposed to ask questions?" Charles Wallace demanded severely. The boy went white, just as the woman had. "I humbly beg your pardon. I must continue my route now. or I will have to talk my timing into the explainer. And he shot off down the street on his machine. Charles Wallace stared after him. What is it? He asked Megan Calvin. There was something funny about the way he talked, as though, well, as though he weren't really doing the talking. Know what I mean?
Irony that this is being read out loud by someone who isn't really doing the talking, but what's the
Calvin nodded thoughtfully. Funny is right. Funny peculiar. Not only the way he talked, either. The whole thing smells. Come on, Meg pulled at them. How many times was it that she had urged them on? Let's go find Father. He'll be able to explain it all to us. They walked on. After several more blocks, they began to see other people, grown-up people, not children, walking up and down and across the streets. These people ignored the children entirely, seeming to be completely intent on their own business. Some of them went into the apartment buildings. Some of them were heading in the same direction as the children. As these people came to the main street from the side streets, they would swing around the corners with an odd, automatic stride, as though they were so deep in their own problems and the route was so familiar that they didn't have to pay any attention to where they were going. After a while, the apartment buildings gave way to what must have been office buildings, great, stern structures with enormous entrances. Men and women with briefcases poured in and out. Charles Wallace went up to one of the women, saying politely, "Excuse me, but could you please tell me?" But she hardly glanced at him as she continued on her way. "Look," Meg pointed. Ahead of them, across a square, was the largest building they had ever seen, higher than the Empire State Building and almost as long as it was high. Noting this was written in the 60s. Or released in the 60s.
Yeah.
This must be it, Charles Wallace said. Their central intelligence, or whatever it is. Let's go on. But if Father's in some kind of trouble with this planet, Meg objected, isn't that exactly where we shouldn't go? Well, how do you propose finding him? Charles Wallace demanded. I certainly wouldn't ask there. I didn't say anything about asking. But we aren't going to have the faintest idea where or how to begin to look for him until we find out something more about this place, and I have a hunch that that's the place to start. If you have a better idea, Meg, why, of course, just say so. Oh, get down off your high horse, Meg said crossly. Let's go to your old central intelligence and get it over with. Remember, Charles Wallace is at risk here.
Mm-hmm.
I think we ought to have passports or something, Calvin suggested. This is much more than leaving America to go to Europe, and that boy and the woman seem to care so much about having things in proper order. We certainly haven't got any papers in proper order. If we needed passports or papers, Mrs. Watson would have told us so, Charles Wallace said. Calvin put his hands on his hips and looked down at Charles Wallace. Now, look here, old sport. I love those three old girls just as much as you do, but I'm not sure they know everything. They know a lot more than we do. Granted, but you know Mrs. Watsit talked about having been a star. I wouldn't think that being a star would give her much practice in knowing about people. When she tried to be a person, she came pretty close to goofing it up. There was never anybody on land or sea like Mrs. Watsit the way she got herself up. She was just having fun. Charles said. If she wanted to look like you or Meg, I'm sure she could have. Calvin shook his head. I'm not so sure. And these people seem to be people, if you know what I mean. They aren't like us, I grant you that. There's something very offbeat about them. But they're lots more like ordinary people than the ones on Uriel. Do you suppose they're robots? Meg suggested. Charles Wallace shook his head. No, that boy who dropped the ball wasn't any robot, and I don't think the rest of them are either. Let me listen for a moment. They stood very still, side by side, in the shadow of one of the big office buildings. Six large doors kept swinging open, shut, as people went in and out, looking straight ahead, paying no attention to the children whatsoever. Charles wore his listening, probing look. They're not robots, he said suddenly and definitely. I'm not sure what they are, but they're not robots. I can feel minds there. I can't get at them at all, but I can feel them sort of pulsing. Let me try a minute more. The three of them stood there very quietly. The doors kept opening and shutting, and the stiff people hurried in and out, walking jerkily like figures in an old silent movie. Then, abruptly, the stream of movement thinned. There were only a few people, and these moved more rapidly, as if the film had been sped up. One white-faced man in a dark suit looked directly at the children and said, "Oh dear, I shall be late," and flickered into the building. "He's like the white rabbit," Meg giggled nervously. "I'm scared," Charles said. "I can't reach them at all. I'm completely shut out." "We have to find Father," Meg started again. "Meg," Charles Wallace's eyes were wide and frightened. "I'm not sure I'll even know Father. It's been so long, and I was only a baby." Meg's reassurance came quickly. "You'll know him. Of course you'll know him. The way you'd know me, even without looking, because I'm always there for you. You can always reach in." "Yes!" Charles punched one small fist into an open palm with a gesture of great decision. "Let's go to Central Central Intelligence." Calvin reached out and caught both Meg and Charles by the arm. "You remember, when we met, you asked why I was there? And I told you that it was because I had a compulsion, a feeling I just had to come to that particular place at that particular moment?" "Yes, sure." "I've got another feeling, not the same kind, a different one. A feeling that if we go into that building, we're going into terrible danger." Guess what, folks? We are halfway through the book.
Yeah, that was pretty much, we hit 50% in that chapter. And I mean, you know, thinking about like narrative theory, the middle of a story is often when there's a big change, and the three ladies dumping them on a planet and going, "Well, we can't help you anymore. Bye." That's a change.
Yeah, it's a bit of a crisis.
Even worse, Mrs. Who talked not only in quotes, but she said real words.
Yes, and they each gave them gifts. That was the other thing. It's interesting that you had Meg was given her faults.
Because she's been trying so hard to overcome them or get rid of them. But, you know, our faults are part of who we are.
Yes, and in some spaces they can actually be a blessing. Notice how she's been really impatient the whole time. And that's been exaggerated to try and that inertia. Overcome the, like, it's without inertia having that momentum, so pushing them on.
And I've also forgot where I read it, but the idea that, you know, a lot of us to move forward, to improve ourselves, we try and address our faults, to fix them, to improve them. But there's a school of thought that says that's actually the wrong way about it. Your faults are your faults. Accept them. Yes, you should always accept every part of you, but you'd be much better suited to putting all that energy into improving your strengths.
Yes. And also, yeah, or balancing out your faults with strengths. So balancing out, like, if you are a kind person, to also work on your wisdom. If you are assertive, to balance it out with humility. Like, that kind of balance of qualities as a person. But yeah, so what are your feelings about Kamazots?
Well, the whole time I was getting a very, Amazon productivity drop by 5%, you will be punished kind of vibe, you know, very automaton productivity and everything for the great machine, everything for the economy type of vibe. There's obviously a lot of themes and metaphors in this book behind everything, but I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, like, the ultimate evil turns out to be automation, order, greed, just like a lot of negative qualities. Fear is obviously a big one. Everyone in that town is very scared of not doing the right thing.
Yeah. And like, to the point of, nope, that's not our ball. We never drop balls. We've never had an incident. That's not, never happened.
Cause it also feels like it might be one of those places where, you know, one person does something wrong and they wipe the town from the map. Maybe not that explicit, but it felt like, you know, no, we have no aberrations, because when aberrations happen, everyone gets punished.
Yeah. So it's a really kind of, yeah, it's an interesting kind of place.
A terrifying, awful kind of place.
Yes, yes, that too. It's like, it's really creepy. I think when we were doing, I think it might have been Brave New World, I commented, I might have mentioned Wrinkle in Time in passing, I don't remember, but this idea of extreme productivity, both 1984, this is essentially what feels like.
Oh, it is a dystopia at this point. This town is definitely dystopic.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can see it's almost like the concept or something about like that. I'm going to use the word the vibe of 1984 mm-hmm. Brave New World has now been introduced,
mm-hmm.
and they're like, okay, something's wrong. This feels wrong. This is off.
And Calvin's power, his astuteness is pretty much like, yeah, we're not going into room 101. That would be a bad thing.
Yes, don't do this. Or I have a very bad feeling.
Whereas you mentioned as we were reading, but Charles was warned that this place, he's the most of danger because of pride and arrogance. Because so far, at least on Earth, his powers have enabled him to kind of be in control. But here, he can't touch these people.
Also, he's five?
Mm-hmm.
Things to remember. He's a five-year-old.
Yeah.
It's a five-year-old who's... was a baby when his father left,
mm-hmm.
and although he's special and he's a next evolutionary step potentially of a human being, there's also things that he's used to being the person who looks after Meg, for example, mm-hmm. and the fact that Calvin gets told you need to look after Meg,
that threw him for a bit of a loop.
And then going, but why? I do it. Saying, well, you're actually more vulnerable here. You're in more danger than anywhere else.
Mm. The warning against them not being separated, it feels like, because that's going to have to happen. Just like, you know, why bring it up if it's not going to be like an obstacle to overcome for our heroes? It's probably going to be done in their own volition. This place is going to get to them, and they're going to have an argument.
Well, we saw it just almost happening there, where Charles is like, no, I need to understand. I need to know. I need to understand. Mm. So that's the thing. And he got told, he was given a quote by Mrs. Hu that literally said, I don't know everything, and you can't know everything. You don't know. You know a lot, but you don't know everything. And you like that's the thing you have to kind of come to terms with, and that's important.
And your German was lovely.
Ah, thank you. Yes, very German. But yeah, it's this concept of you can't, in his quest to know, he was like, well, I'm going to go up to the door. You guys can keep on, you can keep going on if you want.
Hmm. Yeah,
it's good. We got told not to split up.
you mentioned wisdom. That's the thing that one should gain as they live, you know? And what one of the elements of wisdom is the idea that, you know, you admit that you don't know things, and then you admit that you don't know what you don't know.
The thing that bugs me is that Charles Wallace, one, what will use the guidance given by Mrs. Witch or Mrs. Wallace, like, will use their guidance, and then promptly also ignore it when it suits him.
And he has blind spots, I think. Maybe it is being a kid, or maybe it's just his... his specific powers don't allow him to see the other shades. Like, Calvin was right on the money where he's like, look, those ladies, I love them as much as you, but I don't think they know about people. Look how Mrs. Watts dressed. That's not a person.
Yeah.
So you know, they probably had no idea that we would need papers to be here.
To move, yeah. And that's the thing. And that's why Calvin's also been labeled the communicator, because his ability is words, which we know. His ability is words. Meg's is is maths and science. And she needs facts, but she argues really well. Like with the principal, she argued that situation really well and kind of went, look, my mother's a scientist. And if her facts are saying dad's coming back, you can't accuse my mother of not facing the facts. We face the facts in our home. Like, so she's very like fact. She distorts facts when they come to her perception of herself, as you do.
but her in other ways it's better. And I mean, she told Charles off.
Mm.
Said like I am going to be like, get off your high horse. Like mm-hmm. you're being a bit of a butthead right now.
Mm.
But very protective, has anger, but uses it, channels the anger into action, things like that. So hopefully we'll see how things go.
It was like, just because of the pace of the book, every chapter has been what I'd call an important chapter. But yeah, I foresee that a lot of the book is probably going to be taking place on this planet now.
Yeah, Camazotz is an interesting place so far.
And also, just the feeling of it, it feels like either they've gone through the darkness to get there, or they're in the darkness. Rue's just gesturing wildly.
I'm just gesturing and nodding. I cannot say anything because, yes. So we've got we now know they're going to Central Intelligence, which is where it has found its home. Its home.
And Central, the Central before the second Central, is in all capitals. So it's Central Intelligence. Central.
Yes. So there's some interesting kind of pockets. There's a very strange culture afoot at this place. And it's, they work on it's all about productivity, perfection. Ah.
Stripping out humanity, making men behave like machines. But yeah, I was thinking of the vibe.
So there's a whole bunch of cogs going on.
Mm.
Paper dolls, as it was put, mothers. But they are actually people, as Charles Walls is saying. They are people. They have minds. I can't penetrate the minds.
Because their humanity's been stripped away, so he can't touch them.
Mm-hmm.
That's complex, my theory.
Yes, it's an interesting one. I will go with that theory. But yeah, it's an interesting kind of dynamic. Mm. So yes. So next chapter, ominously, chapter 7, is The Man with Red Eyes.
Oh, jeez, that's not a good... well, considering the way we've been moving, that doesn't fill me with confidence, especially when this when this chapter has been called The Happy Medium.
Yes, so that was the happy medium. So we got
Maybe he's just a man that needs to get more sleep.
It's conjunctivitis. Maybe he's got pink eye. Who knows? So many options for a kid's book. But yes, it's going to be a challenging one. That's for sure.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'll steady myself.
Steady yourself. But yes, so we hope that you will join us next time with our continuation. So the music at the top of the podcast was by Jeff Danos, the score for the 2003 production of A Wrinkle in Time. And the music at the end of the podcast, as always, is I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can catch me on Twitter at Rue McMoo, that's RoomCmoo.
And I am over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip. We have a Twitter page and a Facebook page for the podcast. It is at SMBSLT Podcast, and SMBSLTpodcast@gmail.com is our email address. Please, we would love to hear some feedback from you. How are you enjoying the book? How are you enjoying our discussion? Do you have any ideas of books you would like us to read in the future? We will take them under advisement. We just want to hear from you. And if you listen to the podcast on any place that allows you to rate or review it, we would appreciate that as well.
So hopefully you have a pleasant week. And we will catch you next time. Happy reading.
Bye, folks.